Thank you for this opportunity to share with you my personal journey from the Warsaw Ghetto to the struggle for animal rights. I was 5 years old on September 1st, 1939, when the Nazi armies invaded Poland. About 6 months later, we and about 450,000 other Jews in Warsaw and some of the surrounding areas were ordered to move into the Jewish section of Warsaw under penalty of death. Most had to move in with strangers. We were fortunate in that my grandparents had a large apartment in a Jewish section, so we were able to just move in with them. Eventually, we noticed certain streets being blocked off to traffic, little pieces of wall going up here and there. By November 16, 1940, the walls were joined and the streets were blocked and the Warsaw Ghetto was born. As I said, there were about 450,000 of us. The area of the ghetto was about 5 square kilometers. If you do the calculations, it'll work out to roughly 10 times the population density of Tel Aviv, and you know how crowded that is. Crowding and food shortages became unbearable. Typhus became epidemic, with victims lining the streets. During the first year, an estimated 80 to 100,000 Jews perished from hunger and disease. We did our best to cope with these hardships. There were illegal workshops created to manufacture clothing that was then exported outside the ghetto by children and traded for food. There were health clinics, public soup kitchens, orphanages, libraries, and even a rudimentary school system. A Jewish council, which was working together with the Nazi authorities, took care of the medical responders, police, fire. In mid-1942, roughly summer and fall of 1942, the Nazis began implementation of what they called Operation Reinhardt, and what we today refer to as the Final Solution. Between July and September, they dragged several hundred thousand of Jews from the Warsaw Ghetto to the death camps of Treblinka and Auschwitz. A key element of the operation was thorough deception. We were told that we're being resettled to the east, away from hunger and disease. We were instructed to bring along all our belongings, basically a suitcase. We were told to make sure to put our name on the suitcase in case we were separated. Even the Treblinka gas chamber was decorated with the Star of David to simulate a synagogue. It is estimated that nearly 1 million Jews were exterminated in Treblinka and many more in Auschwitz. They left behind only piles of suitcases, shoes, glasses, hair, and charred bones. Silent memorials to the thousands of sentient living beings who were no more. On April 19th of 1943, several thousand Nazi troops, supported by tanks, entered the ghetto to exterminate the survivors. They were met by vigorous resistance, which lasted 4 weeks. The date of April 19th, the date of the ghetto uprising, is now celebrated throughout the world as Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Day. And here in Israel, of course, you observe it according to the Jewish calendar. On May 16th, after leveling every single building in the ghetto and exterminating any survivors, General Jürgen Strupp reported to Hitler that the Warsaw Ghetto was no more. I am alive today because my grandparents had two blessings. They had some gold jewelry, and they had a living Russian maid named Yuliana. Now, Yuliana only spoke Russian, and she had been with them for many years, and she was part of our family. When the Warsaw Ghetto was formed, just like all Jews had to move in under penalty of death, all Gentiles had to move out under penalty of death. Pretty much anything was under penalty of death, as you can gather. Yuliana refused to leave. Some years earlier, in order to maintain her Russian heritage and culture, she joined a white Russian society, which was the only Russian-speaking society in existence. The white Russians, for those of you who know this history of the early 19th century, 20th century, white Russians were the folks who fought with the Bolsheviks. And of course, they lost and they were exiled. And the Germans cultivated the white Russians because they thought that after the war, they would conquer Russia and use the white Russians as their puppets or proxies in running the country. So Yuliana went to her white Russian society and said that unless she was allowed to stay in a ghetto, she would commit suicide. And sure enough, she got two very important permits. One allowed her to go in and out of the ghetto, and the other, equally important, she was able to bring food in and out. So for a while, that worked well for us because we would give her money and she would buy food outside the ghetto and bring it in. Eventually, we ran out of money, so we would collect clothes from our friends and neighbors. She would wrap them around her body and take them outside, trade them for food, bring the food in, and we would distribute the food to the people, give us clothes, and so forth. During those mass roundups of late 1942, Yuliana got caught. And she was barely able to extricate herself, even with all her permits. My grandmother decided that it was too dangerous for Yuliana to stay with us. She refused. There was a lot of going back and forth, arguing, crying. And finally she agreed, but only on one condition, which is that she would take me with her as her son. So that I would live. My grandparents gave Yuliana three batches of jewelry. One was for the guards at the ghetto gate, so they wouldn't ask too many questions about how Yuliana suddenly had a son. The second was for the hooligans outside the ghetto gate who were there to extract valuables from Jews that were escaping from the ghetto. And a third batch was so that Juliana could start a new life outside the ghetto. My father had a sister who married a Christian, and she passed this Christian. She never went into the ghetto. So Juliana brought me to my aunt's house. And eventually, my mom and my dad were able to join me there as well. My aunt's partner was part of the underground, the Polish underground, and he was able to get us false papers so that we could start a life of 2.5 years in hiding from the Nazi authorities. It was a life of constant alerts to any suspicious sounds, statements, or glances, and occasional close calls. My dad lived separately under different names, so if one of us got caught, it wouldn't implicate the other. I was only 8 at that point, but I was a pretty smart kid, and my mother trained me to report anything out of the ordinary. And sure enough, shortly after we moved into this apartment, I was playing with other kids, and I overheard the mom of one of them saying to the other, "Who is that new kid?" And the other replied, "Oh, he moved into that second floor apartment in the back, where they took out those Jews, the probably more Jews." And of course, I immediately ran home to report this to my mom. She then packed our bags and told the superintendent that I wasn't feeling well and we were moving out to the countryside so I could get some fresh air and recover. We moved in into a farmhouse. We rented a room, which was run by a woman who had 3 sons. The woman didn't want to divide the farm among the 3 sons, so she selected one of them to run the farm with her. The other 2 were living in Warsaw, holding regular jobs. So the issue came up, you know, we didn't have any money. So my mother started going to Warsaw, buying clothes at the street markets, bringing them to the countryside and trading them for food or money. And it got to the point where she became very friendly with all the villagers. She was walking from village to village with all the clothes and her backpack. And at one point, she arrived in a village, and one of her friends said, "You know, I have a funny story to tell you. There is this guy who owns the clothing store up here, and, you know, he never liked you because you're underselling him. And you'd never believe it, but he said that he thinks you're Jewish, and he's going to call the Gestapo to make sure. And I know you're not Jewish, but I'm concerned about your merchandise. You know, when they come, they'll take all your merchandise because what you're doing is illegal, so that wouldn't be a good idea." And my mom thought that was pretty funny, that somebody would think she was Jewish, so she bid him goodbye and walked slowly away till she was out of sight, and then she dropped her backpack and broke into a run. She arrived at the farmhouse after several hours, roughly around midnight, and she said to the woman, "I have to go to Warsaw immediately." The woman woke up the son, said, "Hitch up the horses," tried to argue. She said, "Don't argue with me. Take this woman to the train station." And we were off to Warsaw. Of course, much happened since then, but just to make a long story short, after the war, my mom came back from the labor camp where she was, and she knew the sons in Warsaw because when she was going back and forth to Warsaw, she would bring them food from the farm. And so she found the sons, and through the sons she found the mother. And she asked the woman, she said, you know, I came to you in the middle of the night. And I said I needed to go to Warsaw immediately. You didn't say anything. You just told the son to hitch up the horses. And the woman said, well, you know, I knew all along that you were Jewish, but I don't care about those things. And something else you should know, about an hour after you left, the Gestapo came. Eventually, we were all separated by the Warsaw Uprising, which came a year and a half after the Ghetto Uprising in August of 1944. And my mom, as I said, was deported to a labor camp in Western Germany. After we were liberated, a year later, she came back, found me in an orphanage. We spent 5 years in an Italian refugee camp, and eventually, she emigrated to Israel. This was 1951. In North Tel Aviv is where she spent the rest of her life. And I emigrated to the United States at age 16. And we never heard from my dad. So, once my life was no longer in danger, survivor's guilt kicked in. And the questions I kept asking were, why was I spared when so many good people were not? And how do I repay the debt that I owe for my life? And the obvious answer was to do some good, to end oppression, that sort of thing. But how? So in 1961, I actually did Aliyah to Israel, spent some time with my mom, and I started a league to abolish religious coercion, which was very unsuccessful. I went back to the United States 2 years later. I worked for other social justice movements, but nothing really did the trick. You know, nothing seemed to be just what I needed to deal with my conscience. So in 1972, I moved to Washington to work for an environmental consulting firm specializing in wastewater management. And a couple years later, they sent me to do the wastewater inventory at a slaughterhouse. So I was inspecting the storage and waste areas, and I turned a corner, and all of a sudden, I came across piles of hooves and hearts and skulls and discarded bodies, all silent testimonials to sentient living beings who were no more. I recalled in horror, as most of you would, and memories of death camp piles came flooding into my mind. I tried to dismiss it as mere coincidence, and I said to myself, they're only animals. But it didn't work. The more I thought about it, the more I saw the similarities. The branding or tattooing of serial numbers to identify the victims. The use of cattle cars to transport us to death camps. The crowded housing of victims in wood crates. The arbitrary designation of who lives and who dies. The Christian lives, the Jew dies. Dog lives, pig dies. The constant vilification and abuse of the victims, which would make the killing more accepted. And finally, as I mentioned, a deception about the horrors behind the death camp or the slaughterhouse walls. And while I was going through this turmoil, I came across a quote by Nobel Literature Laureate Isaac Bashevis Singer, who said, "To the animals, all people are Nazis, and life is an eternal Treblinka." And this is when I finally realized that there was a valid reason for my surviving the Holocaust. And there was a valid way to repay the debt I owed for surviving. This is when I realized that this is when I resolved to spend the rest of my life finding all forms of oppression, starting with the oppression of animals, and particularly the animals raised for food. My friends, the most appropriate way to honor the memory of my family and my people in our Holocaust is to show that their sacrifice had not been in vain, that it has taught us some vital, valuable lessons. And lesson number one is that oppression and slaughter of Jews, Armenians, Tutsis, Bosnians, people of color, gays, and yes, the animals are all linked. And they are linked not by the identity or the relative value of the victims. No, they are linked by the oppressive mindset. Yes, each episode of oppression is unique, particular to its victims. Our Holocaust is unique in the systematic way that one nation set out to wipe out another. The animal Holocaust is unique in the overwhelming numbers, hundreds of millions every day. We did not end oppression when we won World War II. One lesson of the Holocaust is that we are all capable of oppression, and many of us actually, perhaps not in this room, but many of us actually subsidize the greatest oppression in the history of the humankind, which every time we shop for food. Most importantly, oppression can only survive through the silent cooperation of the general public. Millions of otherwise well-meaning, upstanding Germans and Polish citizens knew of the death camps in their midst and yet said nothing, just as we all know about the horrors of the factory farm and the slaughterhouse in our midst, and yet we say nothing. As Nobel Peace Laureate Elie Wiesel said, "Silence favors the oppressor, never the victim." But there's an important difference between them and us. The Germans or Poles who spoke up would be shot on the spot. All that we have to do is to change our shopping list the next time we go to the local supermarket and perhaps share our decision on Facebook. Theologians have long debated whether there is life after death. When it comes to animals raised for food, the question I ask is there life before death? (Clears throat) Chickens raised for meat have their beaks cut off shortly after birth to prevent stress-induced pecking. They spend the rest of their lives crowded in large windowless sheds with their throats burned by ammonia and hydrogen sulfide fumes from their excrements. They are fed a hormone-laden diet designed to make them grow to full market weight in only 7 weeks. At the slaughterhouse, they're suspended by their legs and have their throats cut while fully conscious. Let's talk about eggs. Have you ever wondered what happens to half of the chicks who don't lay eggs, the male chicks? They're ground up alive at birth or suffocated slowly in large plastic garbage bags. But in a way, they're the lucky ones because the females are crammed into small cages that allow about this much space per chicken, where they're unable to stretch their wings or to move around, turn around. They are forced to stand on a sloping wire mesh floor that cuts painfully into their feet while the wire mesh walls abrade their feathers and leave painful lesions on their bodies. When the birds are about 15 to 18 months old, their egg production drops and their bodies are so emaciated that they're not even used for human food. They are either discarded or just ground up for animal feed. Dairy cows are raised in large mechanized dairies with no access to the outdoors. Twice a day, they are milked by milking machines. They are artificially inseminated each year and kept pregnant in order to maintain the supply of milk. When their babies are born, they are torn from their mothers at birth so that they wouldn't imprint on the mothers and so that humans can drink the milk that was intended for the babies. The cows search and bellow for the babies for days. But what if this outrageous abuse of animals was really what nature intended? What if this kind of abuse was necessary and actually good for us and good for our environment? That would pose a real ethical challenge to each of us, wouldn't it? We would constantly have to trade off between doing well and doing good, between doing the right thing for ourselves and the right thing for the world. Well, let's take a look. So meat and dairy products are laden with saturated fats, cholesterol, hormones, pathogens, antibiotics, and excess protein. They lack complex carbohydrates, including fiber, and many essential vitamins and minerals. Consumption of animal products has been linked conclusively with increased risk of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and several types of cancer. Conversely, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and legumes supply all essential nutrients, proteins, carbohydrates, fiber, antioxidants, and a variety of phytonutrients which reduce the risk of heart and other chronic diseases. Plant-based foods contain little saturated fat, no cholesterol, and no drugs. Animal agriculture is more devastating to our natural environment than all other human activities combined. This devastation impacts land, water, air, and wildlife. Animals raised for food in the U.S. produce 150 times as much waste as people do. This waste is stored in huge open cesspools, which overflow into our water supplies during rains, storms. According to a 2006 report by the United Nations, as the previous speaker pointed out, animal agriculture generates 18% of man-made greenhouse gas emissions, and more recent studies think that it may be closer to 50%. Animal agriculture has been turning lush forests and prairies into barren deserts since the dawn of human history. The process begins with clear cutting of forests to create pastures for cattle. As pastures become overgrazed, they are plowed under and used for animal feed croplands. Deuteronomy proclaims, "I have set before you life and death, blessing and curses. Therefore, choose life so that you and your children may live." Indeed, my friends, every time we shop for food, we literally make a choice between subsidizing life or subsidizing death. We can choose animal products with their deadly impacts on animals, on our health and our environment, or we can choose healthy, life-affirming foods. Those of you who wonder about protein, plants offer a huge selection of proteins. Those of you who crave the texture and taste of animal products, there again, Israeli ingenuity has taken care of that. And the best way to perhaps convince you that a vegan diet works is I've been a vegan for nearly 40 years and I'm 80 years old. So when it comes to compassionate, healthy eating, my friends, Israel indeed has been a light unto the nations. As many as 13% of Israelis declare themselves as vegans or vegetarians. 25% are reducing their meat consumption. Even the president is a vegetarian. How about that? There are dozens and dozens of superior vegan restaurants. My friends, today is a great opportunity to become part of the trend, part of this glorious movement. I want to thank you again for this opportunity to share my journey from the Warsaw Ghetto to my personal struggle for animal rights and veganism. And I hope that you will all join me if you have not already. Thank you.